Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
Overnight by Jean-Paul L. Garnier. Music by Fog Machine. Overnight. Stretching his legs, Barry knocked over a towering pile of books, stacked so high it was a miracle it hadn't fallen on its own. Looking around his apartment, he saw nothing but such piles, and his desk, which stood empty except for an old manual-style typewriter. None of the modern intrusions such as TVs or radios. I'm such a Luddite, he thought, unashamed. Ignoring the books, he continued his stretching and preparation for his morning job. As one who spent most of his time sitting down, either reading or writing, he was getting out of shape. A friend had suggested that he go out and get more exercise, so he took the suggestion to heart and decided to go for a brief run each morning. Today was to be his first, and he was glad that the forethought of sore muscles had reminded him to stretch. Maybe his legs would hurt that much less. Opening the door into the bright morning light, he was greeted by the sound of helicopters overhead, an unpleasant but common sound in the urban environment. He ran up the driveway, feeling good about having taken the first steps towards fitness, and wondering how long he would last. Regulating his breathing, he sped down the street, enjoying the wind in his hair until his route was thwarted by a red light at the intersection. He jogged in place the way he had seen others do, always thinking that they looked somewhat ridiculous. A black sedan pulled up next to Barry, and the man inside rolled down his window, gesturing to him. Barry, glad for his headphones, pointed to them, and noting the green light, trotted across the street. I'll never get anywhere if I stop and give directions along the way. At least that was the first thing that came to mind. Immediately, he felt guilty about this. His friend that had suggested the jogging had partly done so under the guise of getting him out of the house. If he was to avoid strangers, then part of the reason for the exercise would be moot. Ashamed of his reaction, he removed the earbuds and put them in his pocket. As he crossed the street, he noticed people in the waiting cars pointing at him. Was his discourtesy so apparent that others had noticed it? Maybe he just had a funny gait. It had been ages since he had gone running. He looked over his shoulder and watched the black sedan make a U-turn. No doubt the fellow was looking for the freeway. Feet pounding the pavement, he rounded the corner up the street towards the school. The air was filled with the sounds of recess, shouts and laughter, balls hitting chain-link fences. As he approached, the playground fell silent, and a throng of children pressed themselves up against the gate, all staring at him, none making a sound. Confused and creeped out, Barry picked up speed and did his best to round the next corner as quickly as he could. Rejoicing at reaching the end of the block, he almost didn't see a woman with her grocery cart standing at the stoplight, nearly smacking right into her. The look she gave him in return was not one of anger, but of awe, almost tinged with a bit of praise. Barry trudged on, baffled. Everyone was acting so strangely. Usually people didn't even notice him. It had only been a few blocks and Barry was starting to feel it in his legs. He knew then that he was really out of shape, for his inner self had already begun to tell him to return home. Determined, he blocked the thoughts out and continued to run, even picking up the pace a bit. A black sedan pulled up and drove in pace with Barry. Looking over, he saw that it was the same man that had gestured before. "Mr. President, could I please have a word with you?" Mr. President? What could this man be thinking? Who does he think I am? "Wrong guy, buddy," said Barry, as he ducked into the foot tunnel that crossed under the freeway. The tunnel always smelled like piss, and he had to hold his breath to get through it, but he could never hold it long enough to get all the way to the other side. Taking in a deep breath of the foul air, he emerged from the tunnel and took off towards the park. Excited faces and passing news vans stared and pointed at him. When he turned to avoid them, two teenagers sitting on the bus stop bench took out their phones and started taking pictures of him. What was this? He couldn't look so ridiculous that even teenagers were interested in him. Several blocks up the street, at the light, Barry saw a black sedan take the corner, headed his way. Looking the other direction, he saw that the news van had also turned and was closing in on him. A wave of anxiety took over, and forgetting his fatigue, he bounded back into the tunnel. He ran halfway through, figuring that both vehicles would be waiting for him on the other side, decided to feint and double back towards the exit that led towards the park. At least this might buy him some time to get away, back to the house. But now he was headed in the opposite direction, trying to avoid his pursuers, his fear fueling his muscles. He saw the teenagers get onto their bus. It seemed that everyone on the crowded public transit was also staring at him. Some were even taking pictures. Avoiding the main road, he headed up a hill into the residential part of the neighborhood. There were alleys up this way, and maybe he could cut through them to get back in the direction of his house. Running up the hill zapped his energy reserves, and he was starting to have a hard time regulating his breathing. But he reached the alleyway he was looking for, and it was marvelously free of pedestrians. He made it another two blocks before seeing anyone. A person out walking their dog called out to him and waved. Ignoring them, he took advantage of the now downhill slant and picked up speed back towards the freeway. Five blocks to go and he would be safe back at his place. He felt like he needed a breather and looked for a place to hide and rest for a second. Seeing a garbage truck parked next to a wall, he decided to hang back between them, just out of sight from the street. Regaining his composure, he jogged back into the street, convincing himself that he was probably just being self-conscious about the shape he was in. Making it another block without incident, he was now feeling that things might be back to normal. Then he spotted the sedan. It was several blocks off, but definitely headed towards him. I'm being silly running from this car. The man has obviously just mistaken me for someone else. Resolved to ignore the sedan and its driver, he headed on in the same direction. Reaching the freeway overpass, and only three blocks from home, Barry was brought to a standstill. The news van screeched up in front of him and blocked his path. He stood frozen as a cameraman and reporter jumped out of the vehicle, both with their sights on him. The black sedan parked on the opposite side of the street, and Barry felt as if the world was closing in on him. Stepping out of the car, a man in a black suit crossed the street in his direction. The reporter and the cameraman had set up and were beginning their newscast to his right, freeway behind them as backdrop. Only then did Barry hear the helicopters again. There was a swarm of them above, and Barry realized that the sound had never ceased since he had left the house. He looked up to the copters, but his gaze was stopped halfway as he saw a billboard with his face on it, next to the words, "Our Man." The news camera swung around and pointed at Barry as the newscaster approached him. "Mr. President, how does it feel to be the world's first head of state elected by lottery?" Barry didn't hear what she said or respond. His confusion over the billboard had made him forget about the man in the suit that was now almost on top of him. When he lowered his eyes, he caught sight of the man's lapel blown out by the wind. Beneath, he saw the outline of a pistol. Without thinking, he leapt at the man, afraid for his life. The man in the suit and Barry fell to the ground in awkward embrace. Barry was scrambling for his life, afraid and reacting with animal-like instinct. The man in the suit was trying to subdue him, but did not seem intent on causing harm. Then a gunshot rang out, and Barry rolled off of the man and fell dead in the street. "It went off accidentally. I was here to protect him," moaned the man in the suit, looking dejected and gaunt. "Did we get all that on tape?" cried the newscaster. "Keep that camera rolling." The camera panned to Barry's dead body and then back over to Evelyn, the newscaster. "What started as an amazing day has ended in tragedy. Mr. President, Barry Mitchell, the first president to be elected by lottery, has just been shot in a fatal mix-up with the Secret Service. To date, this is the shortest presidential term in our history and a bad start to the lottery system. The words were drowned out as sirens began to fill the air. Noting this, the cameraman panned upward until his lens reached the billboard with the words spelled out, "Our Man." A Hard Day Hunting Dinosaurs by Brent A. Harris. Music by Red, Blue, Black, Silver.
A Hard Day Hunting Dinosaurs. The creature, quick and bird-like, darted beneath the underbrush. My eyes swept toward it. I took a restrained step closer. Even as a juvenile, my prey was lethal. Just under waist-high, flat brown and green mottled feathers blended in and around the bushes and foliage of the late Mesozoic, a perfect camouflage. My eyes trained forward, not looking for my prey but eliminating where it wasn't. While this was my first time hunting Tyrannosaur, it wasn't my first time hunting dinosaurs. I'd tired of setting lazy traps for Triceratops and snares for Stegos. I chased down the faster ostrich-like creatures and outwitted packs of raptors. Movies made them out to be far more fearsome than the overgrown turkeys they turned out to be. In fact, most of the ones I'd brought back to Earth Prime were no bigger than the young Tyrannosaur I was currently tracking. A disappointment, to say the least. I wanted something bigger. Oh well. I'd bag this one, head back to my beat-up transport truck, punch in the dial for my return trip home, and try another Mesozoic-era Earth in the morning. Dinosaur hunting wasn't as lucrative as it used to be. Too many of us out here doing it now. Most folks back on Earth Prime could order a Bronto burger at their local drive-thru. But it paid the bills, and it was interesting Earth-hopping, seeing all these other Earths in their infancy. We could do whatever we wanted to them. It wasn't going to mess with our timeline. The juvenile Tyrannosaur let out a noise somewhere between a choked chirp and a roar. I suppose it was transitioning from weaning off its mom to learn how to be a little dinosaur. But it must have gotten caught in something, because those stumbling cries sounded like the creature was in distress. It needed help. Luckily, I was there. The Rex's calls lured me on, beckoning me closer. Brushing branches from my face, I followed the pleas into the foliage. She was laying on her side, entangled in roots and branches, feathers flapping wildly. Females had almost no color to them, and they were larger, fiercer than their male counterparts. She ripped and tore at her bindings. I almost felt bad as I raised my rifle and prepared to call it in. Dinosaurs required special transports. I thought better of it. The cost was prohibitive. It bit into my profits, leaving me with even little after the taxes for time, travel, and earth hopping. It's hard making an honest living. I thought I could probably jam this juvenile into my transport and save a few credits. I probably should have kept a closer eye on my surroundings. I was tired and distracted. It'd been a long day and I wanted to go home, crash on the couch, and watch my hometown ball players give lessons on how to lose badly. It was the smell of decomposing meat that made me question where I was. At first, I thought it might mean we were near the little creature's nest. That made sense. She sensed danger and was running home to mommy. No. If I was near the nest, the smell would permeate the air with a sickly, sweet aroma of raw meat and decaying flesh. Instead, the foulness came in waves, hot and sticky. The branches were still, except for where the juvenile thrashed about. There was no wind. The creature settled down and hopped easily and effortlessly out of the tangle of plants and then scooted away. Not a feather was ruffled. The little bastard tricked me. As it turned out, I wasn't the only hunter here. I hit my emergency button as hard and as quick as I could and breathed a sigh of relief when I felt the reassuring buzz signaling that the message had been sent. My message would go back to Earth Prime, and a team of rescuers would track my location and arrive 5 minutes before my stupid, stupid mistake to prevent me from making it. Sure, it would cost me a fortune, and I'd have to pull in twice as much for a while to stay afloat, but at least I'd be alive. I wouldn't be watching ball games anytime soon. I grunted in disapproval. It was my own damned fault. But that timeline didn't exist yet. For now, I'd have to see this one through. The large tyrannosaur poked its pink snout out, exposing teeth long and sharp and jagged enough where I hoped it would be over soon. Yet I knew I'd feel everything in the first few terrifying moments until I finally died of shock or exsanguination. The mother dinosaur had been so still, so peaceful. It was a good arrangement. Let her helpless daughter lure in the food, and then Mama would take the prey down. Only I was the prey, and I had fallen right for it. I guess when there are fail-safes like time travel, it tones down to human instinct to survive. There's little need to be careful, but I should. Oh, I should be very careful next time. This was going to hurt. This was going to hurt so much. The Tyrannosaur lunged.
The Father by Jakes Bailey. Music by Sisudel.
The Father. Two men stood at the base of a hot, dusty canyon filled with dried chaparral. About 40 meters ahead, this canyon fanned out into a sandy meadow, flanked by two steep ridges whose spines graduated until they leveled out with the sand. Clustered around this meadow at the canyon's mouth were a crude, mud-built chapel and a few tents. Beyond that, the terrain flattened for another 25 kilometers until it met the sea. As they left their horses tied in the shade of a lone valley oak, Dr. Salazar listened as Alberto Mejia, the short, bull-necked man guiding him through the brush toward the settlement, prattled on about his work with the priest and the four Indians who lived with them, who he called Salvador, Pedro, Paolo, and Juan. Alberto was unconcerned with formalities, but the doctor couldn't blame him. He was grieving. They quickly arrived at a tent on the edge of the settlement, opposite the chapel. Alberto peeled open a slit in the cowhide to look inside and then gestured for the doctor to enter. The sour smell of a dying body was immediately palpable. Inside, the doctor saw a heavily soiled cot. Standing beside this was a grief-stricken Spaniard who identified himself as Tomas, a soldier. Sitting cross-legged on the floor were the four Indians, and twisted in the cot itself, white as marble and unmoving, his father Jose Francisco Peridal Trevino, a 51-year-old Catalan. As the doctor kneeled to inspect the priest, the two Spaniards tugged at his tunic, asking questions and giving advice all at once. He shooed them away like insects.
"He hasn't taken food or water for 3 days. You must save him. The Indians are his children, and we don't have the faith or strength to complete their journey to Christ. If he is gone, they dance back off into the night of ignorance. He became sick because the Indians forgot to boil his water."
The doctor felt that at least this last point may be correct, for the priest was dying of dysentery. Diarrhea and vomiting had whittled his body to bone and sinew. He had to hold his nose as he patted the priest's tight, jaundiced skin with a wet rag for a few moments, as Alberto and Tomas wrung their hands, their heads cocked over him. "Father Trevino, my name is Dr. Eduardo Salazar. I've come from the fort at San Pedro at the request of your loyal men. Can you hear me?" The priest didn't move or utter a sound beyond the labored breath lapping from his mouth. After wiping his hands with a clean cloth, Salazar turned from the cot and gestured for the Spaniards to follow him outside, before deciding it didn't matter. There was no reason to be discreet. "I'm afraid that the father, being a man of his age, and in such a progressed state of illness, will die within the next day. I would bleed him, but I fear that at this point, it would only cause him undue suffering and delay his deliverance to God." At this, Tomas' face knotted into tears, and he bounded from the tent in one long stride. Alberto, standing like a blackened stump, stared up at the doctor. His teeth flashed in the darkness of the tent as he spoke.
Dr. Salazar, we cannot bury him like this in his filth, like an animal. Do you have good lumber for a coffin? He waved his arm at the cot as if to wrench the hateful words from his throat. And some silk at the fort? Silk in which to wind him?
I'm sure we do, the doctor said softly. Following Alberto outside, he glanced around at the Indians, whose eyes were all solemnly set upon the body twisted in its filthy cot. They didn't move.
Father Jose waited for the wind-dampened voices of the other Spaniards to move farther from the tent, opened his eyes, and rolled over onto his back. The Indians watched him silently from the floor, their blackened faces unmoving in the darkness.
Leave me, my sons, he groaned, and they all left. He rolled back onto his side.
He'd managed to isolate the pain through constant prayer, but the fever was maddening. The knowledge that he would be united with the Holy Trinity and with his knowledge was more comforting than any blanket against the fever's chills or any breeze from the cliffs against its heat. Father Jose was glad to be alone. The Spaniards were constantly prodding at him, trying to force him to speak, and his suffering only abated when he was able to sleep. Even then, the sleep was torturous, and he woke constantly to feel his muscles coiling and crawling like vipers. This, he knew, was the cumulative test of his life. He was visited by horrible images flashing around the walls and ceiling of the tent. A black serpent wound up and down the poles, carrying a thumb-sized shred of skin which he understood to be the foreskin of the infant. A hairy, toothless man in a soiled white tunic secreted water from his palm and let it drip to the floor inches from the priest's dry lips. An old Indian woman, her undoubtedly hideous face shaded by a blue hood, opened her cloak and skidded a cold hand up his belly to his beard. Parting his lips, she squeezed sour milk from her drooping breast into his mouth. He prayed. Oh, St. Jude, I ask you not to cure me, but only to end these tortures and temptations. Allow me the soundness of mind to collect my thoughts in prayer, and if I must live, I will be doubly determined to spread the gospel of our Lord through this heathen land, as you did in the time of our Lord, Jesus Christ. I humbly ask for comfort in my time of dying. Grant me the peace to reflect upon my work and beg our Lord to forgive my sins, and I shall leave my body in this filthy tent as the kernel of God's word among the heathens. And his word shall grow from the wretched soil like their corn, eternal. Outside, Alberto took a deep breath. Even in this dry valley, 25 kilometers from the coast, the west wind brought in the cool, salty air on certain days. It reminded him that the old world still remained outside this bloodless land. It reminded him of Spain. He led the doctor and the still weeping Tomas to the lone valley oak at the edge of the camp, where the horses were tied. For a moment, they watched the crows teetering in the wind above the cliffs, hovering like black angels. All right, it's good. I'll get your things. The twilight seemed to last for hours on these late summer nights. The sky was a peaceful broadcast of orange and purple. Wispy, rose-tinted clouds streaked to the horizon. Tomas and the doctor saddled their horses without speaking as Alberto returned and brought them rifles, canteens, and blankets. You're sure you don't want to wait for the morning? He squinted at the two. Darkness will fall long before you find the fort. Tomas shook his head. I want to bury the father as soon as the Lord takes him. We cannot let him lie in state, not in this heat. I'll return with some soldiers and everything we need for the burial just after dawn. He slung his leg over the saddle, saluted Alberto, and the two horsemen struck off onto the plain. Alberto stood watching the day's last light cast their two long shadows onto the golden cliffsides flanking the valley, nodded to himself, and walked towards the simple mud-built chapel at the head of their encampment. He didn't want to watch the priest die or talk to the Indians. He knew they'd have questions, but he'd resolved to spend the night praying for the old man's soul. As he walked, he spotted something in the shadows from the corner of his eye. The long-haired Indian Salvador, looking very pale, was standing like a ghostly yucca in the chaparral. Alberto had the feeling he'd interrupted the Indian in some sinful act. Don't leave the camp, Salvador. Watch after our father. The Indian stared back in silence. He was the priest's favorite, but he frustrated Alberto. His long hair seemed to conceal a lukewarm, incomplete faith in the Trinity. Go back to the tent. I'll be in the chapel, but do not disturb me. Tomas will be back in the morning. Salvador said nothing. The moment he saw Alberto duck into the chapel, he spun around and ran into the swelling darkness, not making a sound, not even the crackling of a leaf. The light that came through the folds of the tent weakened, fading from blue and orange to ever-deepening violet before all light was finally scrubbed away, and so night fell on the tent and the little settlement, with the doctor and Tomas gone, Jose, Paolo, and Pedro sleeping on the ground, Alberto praying in the mud chapel,
Salvador missing, and the priest, who had exhausted himself with prayer, falling into a deep, numbing sleep. Hours passed and the night was full when Father Jose Francisco Peridal de Trevino awoke to the sound of heavy nose breathing and the rustling of cowhide. Looking up, startled and annoyed, he saw Salvador's sweat-streaked and moonlit face emerge through the slit like a newborn. The Indian stepped in and kneeled, ignoring the priest, and began unfolding a strip of leather or cloth on his thigh. Inside was a pillowy, flower-like green powder and a hollow, finger-sized bone. Father Jose was certain that this was no illusion. He watched wearily as Salvador pushed the powder into a pyramid with his thumbs, breathing rhythmically through his nose, and pressed the end of the bone into it. He turned the powder-clogged bone in his fingers and crawled on his knees to the priest. "Father, forgive me. My birth father told me this medicine will save you, so that you may save us all. I mean no sacrilege, and may the three gods have mercy on me," he whispered, and hovered over the priest, holding the upturned bone before him. "My child, there is only what—" Salvador pushed the bone into the priest's left nostril through his wet, wiry mustache, and fired the powder far into his sinus with a blast of air from deep in his chest. At once, the priest felt a sheet of searing pain tear from his face down the left side of his body to his toes, his eye filled with tears. The Indian slipped out of the tent and disappeared into the night, leaving the old man rolling in confused agony. The relentless storm of pain that had lashed him to the cot for days quickly began to dissolve. His legs, and then his arms, and finally his torso, fell numb. He could feel his throat gently closing like a wilting flower, and pure darkness crept out from the corners of his eyes, overtaking everything until only a tiny pinhole of light remained above him. As his physical body seemed to vanish, he kept up a steady drumbeat of prayer. He wasn't afraid, but relieved to know he was dying. "I think I'm smiling," he thought. "The men will be happy to find me that way." Then that final pinhole of light was gone, as if by a stroke from a swift black brush. The near euphoric erasure of his senses gave way to something else. It was as if a door had closed behind him and he was left in an unlit waiting room, no second door in sight. He could feel nothing, no pain, no fever, no breath. There were no voices of the dead, no singing of the angels, no broken seals, yet he could sense movement, either the movement of his soul or the movement of the void around him. His faith in the process of attaining immortality trembled. And in that moment of uncertainty, an array of soft, golden lights began to appear. Stars. The acknowledgement of a life of faith and fidelity, of bare servitude, of wandering the barren wildernesses of New Spain, had come in the form of a celestial kingdom of God. The evaporation of his body now complete, he felt his soul given to the stars. As they brightened, he scanned them. Was each an individual heaven? Would one of these stars be host to his immortality, where he would dwell in peace, freed from the anguish of befuddlement at the mysteries of the universe? Would his loved ones, the angels, and his earthly and heavenly delights come and go from it at his will? A gentle cascade of thoughts ran through him, like streams of clear water breaking from a mountain glacier. This marvelous web of lights widened as new lights faded in around its perimeter, and, as it expanded, the stars in its nebulous center brightened. Soon they filled his field of vision, still cast against blackness. They were getting closer, or he was drawing closer to them, and an order began to form amongst them, a grid. The darkness between them began to develop character and shade. He could make out angles, perspective, form. What seemed to be deep space began to flatten. The flowing euphoria narrowed into a fearful trickle through the heart of his being. "This is the ascension. Why am I afraid? Remember, Jose, you've been faithful. Lord, O blessed Trinity, reassure me, thy humble slave, that it is unto thy kingdom I am cast." As he prayed, the array of light and shadow hardened. He felt now that he was approaching it from above, and it lay spread out beneath him as far as he could see. "It is not emptiness," he thought with relief. "The lights are windows." A tide of warmth rose within him. These were lit rooms in God's great fortress. He willed himself closer. His ecstasy swelled, but with each new development he felt a stab of uncertainty. What now were these great streams of rushing lights, red on one side, gold and white on the other, that stretched and wound like arteries throughout the entire web, the nature of which began to appear increasingly one-dimensional? With a sudden and widening roar, there was sound, a demonic, metallic, and violent symphony, and there was smell, the foulest smell he'd ever sensed. Outside the broken walls of Turin, when he was a young soldier, he'd slept inside an exploded cow for warmth over a winter's night.
but that could have been a rose-filled hollow compared to this wretchedness. The acuity of his senses also confused him. Had he entered immortality with the senses of an earthly being? As quickly as each question sprouted, it fragmented into more, until they overcame him like roaring insects. This loud, stinking fortress, or city, surrounded him as he drifted down to a pitch-dark patch, and found himself planted atop a rocky crag, covered in puffs of the low shrubbery and chaparral that he immediately recognized. At the foot of the hill, obscuring much of his view, stood an imposing black square, more imposing than the cathedral at Salamanca, and racked with hundreds of single-paneled windows, burning with a flat, piercing light. On top, grave-like against the starless night sky, stood a single cross. He moved down to the building, not conscious of his legs dragging through the chaparral, if he had any legs at all, amid the strange sounds of metallic rushing and distant horn blasts, and in moments, he was inside. The building glowed with that harsh, acrid light he'd seen streaming through its windows. Its walls were a sour white, blank, undecorated. He moved through a thicket of the strangest people he'd ever seen. Not Spaniards, not Indians, nor Englishmen, nor Moors, but glassy-eyed, bitter-looking, sour-smelling, and fat. Despite their fatness, he knew they weren't rich, but absolutely poor. Some of them stood or sat yelling at no one, a hand pressed to their cheek, and some sat staring at the walls or their hands with the exhausted carelessness of dying dogs. "Is this hell?" thought the tired priest. A formless voice, if it could be called a voice, answered wordlessly in the negative. It came neither from within nor without him. "My holy father, is that you?" The voice, if it could be called a voice, was absent. The human forms took no notice of him. Several masked people burst through a door, pushing a man on a wheeled cot, whose body was torn and mutilated in ways that Perdidal had not seen since the war in Italy. A woman, the fattest he'd ever seen, and clad in tight-fitting, stained clothes, screamed in oddly accented English at a young girl sitting in a chair. She ignored her. They all seemed to be of a race he couldn't identify, but their faces looked bloodless, their flesh sad, their eyes hollow, hopeless. The priest was overcome with fear and suffocating sadness. He realized, in this bright, stinking room, that he couldn't close his eyes, but he wanted to see no more. He felt that God had forgotten him, and in turn, he'd forgotten him. He gathered a strength that had never existed to him before and began to ascend, much like he had willed himself closer to those lights he had mistaken for God's kingdom, through the ceiling. He emerged in a succession of white hallways with white floors that shined like the sweaty skin of a dying body. Through every wall he could see humans twisted in painful shapes, riddled with the growing weeds of scourge, waiting for lonely death. Thousands of unknown poisons throbbed in all the blood behind those walls. "Are these still God's children?" thought the priest. The answer came, and he knew that these were the children of men and women. Father Jose left the building through its roof, allowing him one last look at the tall, grave-like cross as it slipped from him. Nothing ever looked so sinister. It seemed to follow him through the darkness, like an executioner watching the condemned walk towards the block. The lights of the city stretched out before him as far as he could see, mutated by heat and gas, terminating at a blurred horizon. He willed himself up to the starless night. Salvador and the three other Indians stood watch outside Father Jose's tent for hours after he'd died. In the dead of the night, as the moonlight was just retreating from the rocky crag above their camp, they heard him coughing from his cot. They traded terrified glances. Through the gurgling coughs, the priest called Salvador's name. "My son, my son, my son." Still sweaty and dusty from his long run back to the tribe's old village by the creek, the young man bowed into the tent while the others stood outside. He found the priest sitting up on his elbows, waiting. His smiling teeth shone in the dark. "Salvador, my son, there's so little time left. I must ask you to do something, and you must do it, if you ever loved me. Do you understand what's happened to me?" "Yes, father." "Where are the other Spaniards?" "Brother Alberto is in the chapel. Brother Tomas rode with the doctor to the soldiers' fort." "Salvador, my son, you and your brothers must do exactly as I say. Fetch weapons from your homes. Gather the other Indian men. Kill Alberto, kill Tomas, and burn the chapel with all the holy books inside. Go to the fort and kill the soldiers. Burn everything. If I am still alive when you return, kill me." "My father, is this your will?" "Yes, it is the will of God."
For this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard Overnight by Jean-Paul L. Garnier, read by the author, with music by Fog Machine. A Hard Day Hunting Dinosaurs by Brent A. Harris, read by Zara Khan, music by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. And The Father by Jakes Bailey, read by the author, with music by Sisudel. Theme music by Dane Liscombe. Be sure to visit us at www.spacecowboybooks.com.